Okay, walking with Lucy. If I am honest, and I am, Lucy Walker was not a woman to turn heads. When I met her that summer of 1858 in the sunny Alps, I barely noticed her in the way that a man is apt to notice a woman. She, her brother, and their father were all the same to me. Lucy was tall as I am, and her skin was the shade of porridge left overnight in the pan. Her bust was rather flat, her waist somewhat thick, and she wore round, wire-rimmed spectacles on the end of her considerable nose. When we were introduced, she put out her hand like a man. "Mr. Anderegg, I can hardly wait." Had a squat, ugly drum rippled like a mountain brook in spring, I would not have been more disarmed. I was to be their guide. Frank and young Horace had some knowledge of the Alps, but Lucy had scarcely adventured beyond Liverpool before that season. On her doctor's recommendation, she was given to pain in her joints. She had resolved to join her family on their annual mountaineering trip. "Oh, Lucy, oh, must you?" her mother had said. But Lucy's mind was made up. At 22, she already had the force of an autumn gale. To assuage her mother, though, she climbed in a white print dress, and its wide skirts quite hid the sturdy boots beneath. Mrs. Walker's pointed praise of other girls, "such little ladies," and her disappointment, which grew with her daughter, ensured that Lucy never exchanged her dresses for more practical garb, even as a motherless woman past 40. I can see her that first summer now, swinging her stick as she walked, skirts clinging to her thighs like whining infants. She was a remarkable talent. I cannot say that I have climbed with a man her equal. While not at a glance an athlete, she could hike for many hours without so much as slowing her pace. She relished heights and could face the most vertiginous ledge with equanimity. She seemed untouched by heat or cold, and a goat whose first steps were taken on a rockfall would not have been more sure-footed. The other guides mocked me for my tremulous praise of her early feats and referred to her amongst themselves as the bull. But after a few weeks with Lucy Walker, I had no patience with the view that women belong in the lowlands. That second year, we crossed the passes of Mount Morrow and Theodal, and by the end of the third, attempted the Finsteraarhorn and succeeded. I had been climbing since my small boyhood and guiding since the age of 14, and never had I met such determination. Not quite halfway up Monte Rosa, Lucy was forced to remove her left boot to examine a blister. It was crimson and as large and swollen as an egg, and I knew it would be smarting violently, but she would not let it defeat her. She lanced the blister with sewing scissors and rubbed the raw skin with salt from her food pack, and my eyes watered more with seeing it than hers did. One afternoon, towards the end of August 1862, we stood together, our small, exhilarated party, enjoying the burn in our limbs and the sharpness in our throats. "Well, Luce," Horace rasped, "how is it to be the very first lady here?" Lucy was breathing freely, unstrained, and her face was as flat and off-white as ever beside her brother's flaming cheeks. "Who are we to say that I am the first?" she said, grinning like a queen. "Why, Mr. Darwin's eight ladies might have galloped up for picnics on Sundays." Sometimes she was as modest as her mother could have wished. With each peak achieved, she studied her huge stained atlas for the next, her father, old Frank, shaking his head. "Lucy, Lucy, my dear, are you quite sure? Lucy, my dear." And each time Lucy would reply, laughing like an avalanche, "Just one more par, I promise. and this will not be so hard as the last, though each time she knew it would be harder, and Frank would stare as though he had spawned a griffin. Perhaps the greatest marvel was how she fueled it all. She could eat a Victoria sponge in a single sitting, and frequently did, pausing only to lick the fine sugar from her lips or to brush the cascading golden crumbs further down her dress. While others relied on sausage and potato washed down with canisters of water, Lucy had a taste for fancies of butter and air. She rarely climbed without a bottle of champagne, claiming that the bubbles kept her spirits up in any adversity, from slippery boulders to a mislaid route. In those days, there were fewer mountain huts than there are now. It was therefore desirable, where possible, to complete an expedition without a stopover. And we would often start from the valley at midnight, reaching the top in the height of the day and descending until late in the evening. With so many hours in each other's company, one might suspect that we came to know each other well, and so we did, though we rarely spoke of ourselves. Our conversation was of the map, and of what to do at the fork of a path, of the creatures we startled, the identification of rocks, and the weather our constant foe. At times, Lucy chattered to herself in French or Spanish or Italian. She was a formidable linguist. Or sang English hymns in her reverberating alto. But at the summit, she was always quiet and radiant as a cat. In the early years, there were allusions to marriage. Horace might drop in a playful remark about some likely young man or another, while Frank hinted in warm tones of the family's hopes for Lucy. At this, she most often tossed her head and accelerated, leaving us all in her wake. "But what of your bloom?" her mother would say, so Lucy later told me. "When the bud has perished on the stalk, mother, there is nothing to fear from the future," she would reply. And it was true that she never faded with age, as the women who dread it commonly do. Though this would not have contented poor petite Mrs. Walker, who had received 8 proposals by the age of 19. She told me this herself. Gradually, all mention of marriage fell away, and with it society's insistence on chaperoning, as if, in Lucy's case, a lit fuse had been discovered to be quite stamped out. And perhaps her steps became imperceptibly lighter when she knew that there would be no one now to dictate them. We were no longer young when I came to realise that I lived for these summers with Lucy. I remember watching her once, as she watched a great eagle wheel overhead, its pinions caressing the mountainside. There was something in her gaze, plain as if she met the eyes of God and did not find herself wanting, clean and fearless as a blade, that deluged me with such admiration and desire I was near toppled and remained speechless for an hour. "Mr. Anderegg, look," she whispered. But I could not lift my face from her strong, vital body, her vaulting smile. To celebrate our famous triumph over the mighty Matterhorn in 1871, I journeyed to visit the Walkers in Liverpool. They had invited me to their home off-season for years, and that winter, the lure of Christmas in their comfortable home by Toxteth Park, as described to me by Horace, was too powerful to resist, as was the thought of Lucy. I am an honest man. It was a fascination to me to see her in this other world, with footstools where there should have been rocky outcrops, and modest crystal chandeliers in place of hail and snow. She liked to sit by the fire, her large fingers whipping the tiny silver needle through her embroidery like a fish. As a guest, Lucy left me wanting for nothing. Hot water awaited me on waking each morning, and slippers were warmed for me on the hearth each afternoon. We would walk together in the park after luncheon, though it seemed so tame for her there, I was given to thinking of the great white bear I had seen once in its cage. Her father was in his last illness then, and her mother retired early. On the evening before I was to leave, I tried to speak as I had never spoken before. "Lucy." Honeysuckle arched up the tablecloth, billowing white on her knees. She smiled. "Melchior." She liked my name. She always said so. When we hiked at night, she teased me about which star we should be following, or addressed me, "Your Majesty, O Wise One." I sometimes wonder, Lucy, whether you and I... What shall it be next summer, Melchior? I have a reputation to keep up now, you know. The ladies at the Alpine Club are quite on pins. Does a Jungfrau appeal? I thought of reaching across to lay my hand on hers, but then thought better of it. Had we ever touched without a rope or an ice hammer passing between us? "I'm fond, Lucy, so very fond. And I of you. A girl never had a better guide." She stood heavily and slowly folded her glowing stitches into the linen. Before going to the door, Lucy bent and kissed my head, and it seemed to me that she paused a moment to inhale my thinning hair. I clasped her hand to kiss her broad, rough palm, but she drew herself gently away. "Good night, dear friend," she said, and turned to the stair. By March, her father was dead, and while she spent the summer with her mother in Liverpool, I climbed with Horace. But the year after that, when we were free again, we conquered the Jungfrau. Then came the summers of the Taschhorn, the Eiger, and the Weisshorn. And never again did I come so near the precipice. There was something between us, invisible and not quite a secret, breathing softly. And we found we did not need to feed or coax it for it to live very well and warm us through long winters apart. And this summer now, she is not here. She will not be, through all the years to come. Instead, I am guiding for rich young men who start too quickly and tire easily. My head is smooth and bare as granite, and my hips have started to creak. Lucy's doctor has recommended a more restful lifestyle, one more suited to her age, or so he says. She writes to me of her nieces and nephews, of tea parties, of her determination to master Japanese. Perhaps her mother's ghost has won her from us after all, the mountains and me. I cannot believe in an illness with the energy to overtake her powerful, relentless frame. Sometimes at night, in a hut on the hillside, wrapped in a vast purple sky, I resolve to go to her. I conjure the ticket crisp in my hand, the clunk of the ferry docking, the rattle of the train, the clear loud note of the Walker's Liverpudlian bell. I see how I could kneel in my best suit, long unworn and loose now on my wind-bitten flesh, and press her into a marriage. In those hours it seems that this is what a man and woman must be to each other. That I am not quite the right sort of fellow would surely be of scant significance in these late days. But there is nothing of the bride about her, and precious little of the groom about me, and in the morning I am restored to my faith in what we are. In the new sun I picture her, in the hat she never removed, however hard the climb, of the kind that other ladies wear to church. Her spectacles glittering with light as it glances off the ice. I begin to walk to the beat of my heart where she walks still, letting my tread fall in with hers, always before me on the path, sure and steady as time. The valleys ring with the echo of her boots, and we are divided then by the distance between the wingtips of a moth beating upwards to the moon.
Thank you.